Warning, Star Trek From the Holodeck contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
Lock it alone!
Fire.
Holodeck 3 program is reinstated.
Open sesame!
Commander Klingon vessel. We are energizing transporter beam. Now.
Welcome, everyone. This is From the Holodeck. If you're new to our podcast, you can find all of our shows, past, present, wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search From the Holodeck. This is the Starfleet Academy edition, and we are going to be working through every single episode of its inaugural season. Hopefully, we'll be happy and pleased, and we will not become the fans we don't want to be.
Yes, yes.
And listen, people may have listened to our last discussion and rolled their eyes and said, fuck these shills. But I will be honest with my opinions. If an episode is not great, we're never going to shy away from telling our truths.
Yeah.
And as I said during our last discussion, you know, Starfleet Academy does bring an assortment of problems.
It does.
And this specific episode titled Beta Test brings problems, issues, and even more fears.
Whew.
Like I said during our first discussion, I do like that the series feels different.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely a good thing. Change is necessary. But there were moments in this episode where I genuinely wasn't sure what I was watching. Is this Star Trek or a new episode of Beverly Hills 90210?
Oh my God, yeah.
Or with its busyness, its frenzied aesthetic, does it want to be a new Star Wars series? With robots flying through scenes and big CGI assets bouncing across the screen that are not seamless? They actually feel like they're separate from the actual scene?
Mm-hmm.
When the dots, is that what they were? Dots?
Yeah.
Those robots that were introduced, I believe, in Lower Decks. Is that what? Well, actually, it was in TNG. And then Lower Decks. Those things didn't even look like they were really in the scene.
Yeah.
So when you bring in an asset, like a digital asset, you have to do something called color grading. And what it does is it takes the layers and it blends it in. So it makes it look like those assets are actually a part of the scene. And when you don't do correct grading, oftentimes, those aspects look like they're separate.
Yes.
They look distinctly separate from the scene, like they don't belong. And I was confused at what they were attempting to do. Are they trying to show the liveliness of Starfleet Academy, that there's just a lot going on? They wanted to show how a college really feels like, which, listen, we've all been to universities, and universities are largely like that. When you're walking to class, there's a bunch of different character types all over the place. Things are happening, but it was fucking bizarre. It felt like a smorgasbord of what the fuck shenanigans. Like, what can we throw into these scenes to make it feel that much more busy?
I think the best way of putting it, me and you talked about this off of air, was it reminds us of George Lucas and the special editions, when the first special editions ever came out. And you had, for me, the Jabba the Hutt scene with Han Solo. It looks very weird and it doesn't fit. But you're going to force it. We're going to force this image in with the scene where, number one, the actors probably didn't know what was going on. So there's no reaction to them with the chaos around them.
Yeah, there are certain CGI assets that pass through the scene.
Yeah.
And it gets enmeshed with the eye line of the actors, and they don't react to something passing right in front of their face.
Exactly. And that's the thing I was very surprised. Because like what you said, I expected something like this, but I guess I the best way to put it, I expect better quality in craftsmanship if you're going to do this. Because, like, we've seen Star Trek up into, I mean, me and you have talked about it. Kurtzman's era of Star Trek has some of the best special effects we've ever seen in a long time. Yeah, we've had our moments. Riker summoning all the same fleet of starships.
Yeah, well, yeah.
That happened.
Ending of Picard, yeah.
Yeah, the ending of Picard. That was not great. But, like, we expect better quality of effects than what we saw.
Well, especially with all the innovations of pre-viz, you know, meaning if you don't know what, people don't know what pre-viz is, it's just a way of talking about your pre-production and your planning, you know, your scenes. I mean, you have all these, you have artificial intelligence, AI can just completely develop and flesh out your pre-viz. There are programs that have been used for like the last 20 plus years. There's no reason for actors not to know what's happening
around them
in a scene so that they can react appropriately. So that was some of my problems and just the busyness, because Deep Space Nine had the same effect. You know, you had people walking all the time along the promenade. There were people coming in and out of shuttle bays, but it never felt overly busy. This felt like it felt conflated to the point of bursting at times.
It felt like a very try hard. Type of moment for the team on Starfleet Academy. Like, to me, a lot of the visuals in this episode felt like they wanted to come out guns a-blazing and show people off. But in doing so, they overdid it. And I'm left with, like, this didn't look like a Star Trek episode.
I think there's something to be said about moderation, you know? So setting that aside, not only did the episode, you know, feel conflated in what we had just relayed, but also just in terms of narrative, there was a kind of narrative overcrowding in the episode. And look, Trek has always had ensembles like, you know, Deep Space Nine, as we keep bringing up, but the balancing act that Deep Space Nine maintained, where you had a large cast, it still felt coherent and purposeful. And that wasn't really present in this episode. It didn't feel like it was coherent or purposeful. It just felt like, hey, we need to show a lot of glitz and things so that we can sell this idea that the school is busy, but it really didn't have any true intent beyond that. And because you had so much what the fuck, it just felt overly conflated. It felt like the writer struggled to articulate anything succinctly. We were bouncing from class to class, gag to gag, subplot to subplot, and the episode keeps insisting at the same time on momentum rather than earning it through clarity. So that said, there were genuine efforts to ground the episode through actual stakes. That's a positive to the episode. And that's where the episode actually works best. The diplomatic thread, for example, with the Betazoids.
Yes.
Is conceptually the strongest spine of the entire episode. You have a former Federation world that became isolationist, which definitely speaks again to today's political environment. There's a lot of people, both mostly on the fringe right currently, that are adamant isolationists that feel like we should withdraw from the world completely in order to better serve American citizens. And we already know, people forget history. We already know what happens when we become isolationists. We don't need to relive this. However, Star Trek doing what Star Trek does best, reminding us
what happened,
the issues of isolationism and what comes with that. So, you know, you have this civilization, Beta Zed, you know, behind a defensive barrier, now being courted back into the fold. I mean, that's classic Star Trek terrain.
Yeah.
Diplomacy, compromise, persuasion, and the tension between safety and connection. So all of that was solid. That was a great spine, a good foundation of the episode. And, you know, credit where credit's due. The episode does succeed, at least on paper, in presenting diplomacy as a process of negotiating perspectives rather than simply defeating an enemy. That's not Star Trek. Yes. Star Trek is about negotiation, compromise, and communication. And on that aspect, this episode absolutely shines.
Yeah.
So for people who are not quite familiar, because the War College is somewhat new, the War College was an educational institution responsible for training Starfleet officers after the burn in the mid-31st century, which was just obvious because they had to switch from the typical science and exploration to focus more on defense because they were being attacked from all sides.
Yeah.
With the dismantling or the falling apart of the Federation because the inability to keep it functional without warp drive was without an impossibility. Speed. Yeah. So that is interesting. That's something that I really wanted Discovery to flesh out more, like the after effects of the burn and how it really changed the universe. And they went into it in areas that worked for that specific show. But here we are now dealing directly with the effects of the burn and how it shapes future Starfleet officers. Now we're in some territory that I'm definitely looking forward to getting into. And just going briefly right back to the diplomacy, just for a moment, between the Betazoids and Starfleet. One thing that I liked about it as well was that these are real world types of questions being staged. Like, what do societies owe each other, if anything? What does it cost to rejoin a group? And what gets sacrificed in the name of security? And none of that is new to Star Trek, but it is familiar for a reason. It's part of the franchise's DNA. These are the types of questions Star Trek has always posed. That's what I'm always looking for in an episode of Star Trek. Let's pose those philosophical and socio-political questions. And yeah, that's what they were doing in this episode. Now, when you pose questions, you don't always need to answer those questions. Oftentimes, open-ending questions are enough to really get the audience themselves thinking. In fact, oftentimes, that's where Star Trek shines, is in those open-ended questions. Not telling us how to think, but presenting the better way of thinking through narrative itself rather than just directly telling us. And that's largely what was happening here, because you have this idea, the entire premise of the show is built on the youth, the new generation, and how the new generation is the optimistic view and that they are the future. This is nothing new. This is something we've heard ever since we can remember, David, in the real world. You graduate high school and you have that one kid, you know, screaming at the top of their lungs, the valedictorian, "Oh, we are the future. The future is ours." Like, this is nothing new. In fact, in politics, we time and time again, especially right now, currently with the college protests, what do people on the left continually say? We should listen to the children.
Children.
These are the ones who are the future. You know, so whether or not you agree with that isn't the point. The point is these are real world things that are going on. And as I said during our last discussion, one of the silent co-writers of Star Trek is and always should be culture. Doesn't mean you need to agree with being said, but the realities of these arguments, these discussions should be articulated in Star Trek if you're dealing with proper Star Trek.
Yeah.
So that was definitely a highlight for me. But one of my fears did come through in this episode, and that's the tendency to lean into YA storytelling as a default mode. And it's not that YA is inherently bad, it's that it often comes with shortcuts.
Yes.
Like turning every fucking dynamic into a house rivalry, or every high level political decision to something emotionally legible through teen romance beats
and angst.
You can tell a story about youth without dumbing down the maturity of the storytelling. And there were moments that felt incredibly naive and immature.
Yes. I'm sorry, Caleb. Caleb, I loved Caleb in the first episode.
He great.
Great.
And listen, as an actor, he was great in the second episode, but the stuff that was written for him, and not just him, the Betazoid, what's her name? Sadal?
Sadal.
I think there's a lot of potential there. A lot of potential. But even she was just, why were they melancholic together?
Yes!
It felt like, hey guys, this is a common trope when it comes to teen romance. So let's have them both, you know, find walk solidarity in their melancholy.
Yeah, with each other down the aisles and talk to each other.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's cringeworthy. It's really cringeworthy when you see that. And when I see personally that type of storytelling, I always make the notion, oh, it's CW all over again. And a really good one was the one that you pointed out with the poster in the last episode, where it's like no one forgets their first crew, and it's like fucking Dawson's Creek. And I'm like going, no, that's not Star Trek. Star Trek is not melancholy. Star Trek is not that type of storytelling, because Trekkies are not naive. Trekkies are supposed to be optimistic and hopeful, not naive.
Yeah, it's I don't know. I think you can have naivety in a series, but this was very distinctly YA.
Yes.
You can have angst.
Like, they had a scene of Caleb climbing a wall. That is a stereotypical YA maneuver. The person trying to get away from the establishment. And I'm like going, why are we doing this? I get, and a sliver of my brain was basically going, well, the goal of Caleb this episode still runs from episode one. He wants to find his mom. Okay, he's got a clue.
But dude, we've already gone through these. Like, that's
exactly
the thing.
Exactly.
Your indecisiveness, you know, whether you're going to stay or not, you already made that definitive decision in the last episode.
Yes.
Now here we are again going back and forth. And if the entire season is him going back and forth, I'm going to fucking take a phaser, set it to kill, and aim it right at my fucking head.
Exactly. Because that was the thing too that I took away from, is like, Caleb, did you forget episode one? Did you forget, like, yeah, the decisions you make affect everybody. And here in this episode, your decision is affecting everybody. And the difference between episode one and episode two is, episode one, Caleb understood the ramifications in the end. He saw the consequences of his actions. Episode two, I really don't get the sense he gets the consequences of his actions, because he does, you know, the bad stuff happens. I guess you could say it's bad stuff, but like at the end of the day, did Caleb learn anything from that? And the answer to me is no, it doesn't seem like he learned anything.
I don't feel like he organically, if you look at the plotting, okay, he didn't learn anything organically. He just went through the expected beats that you would expect to have dealing with this type of angst. Yes. There wasn't anything worked towards. Like, he didn't come to the conclusion of anything new by the end of the episode. They had that small little thread there, David, about trust between him and the captain. And that was the thread that was supposed to bring all of it together. Like, trust in the process, Caleb. Trust me. If you don't trust the Federation, trust me, because I left Starfleet after what happened to you to go search for you, to pay, you know, a penance of sorts for my own lack of moral fortitude, let's say. So the idea that, hey, forget about Starfleet for a moment, have trust in me. And the way the episode ended with her throwing the actual apple at Caleb, Caleb taking the bite and knowing that it's an apple, shows that trust that was introduced, that idea that was introduced earlier in the episode. So all that works. But in terms of his angst, it didn't really come through. It wasn't organic. It was simply beats that needed to be there because that's the story you wanted to tell. It actually didn't warrant anything. He didn't learn anything new by the end of the episode. If anything, he was inspired by the girl herself and her desire to stand up for the future and know that they cannot live in a functional society as isolationists, that they must explore and leave the boundaries of their home and become part of the larger group of individuals, a larger part of society. That all makes sense. But when it comes to this, the back and forth, I just don't get why we came back to that.
Mm-hmm.
And also, again, it was not organically worked towards. So that was one of my biggest problems with the episode.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, and overall, like that entire issue that both of us have affects not just Caleb, but all the other characters. Like when you have like this wishy-washiness of a story, of a narrative, a lot of the other characters suffer and basically almost get regulated to, hi, how's it going? I'm just right here. All right, I'm bye. I'll see you later.
Yeah, you can't convince us of what your story wants to be by telling us repeatedly or forcing things in that aren't organic. It's the same thing with them continually telling us that the children are the future. They're the ambassadors of now. We get it. The premise. If you have to keep saying what the premise is, then you're not writing correctly. We should know just by having all the young stand up to show their support for this negotiation of bringing Beta Zed back into the Federation. Mm-hmm. That's more than we need to understand that the youth is leading the charge. In progress. We don't need to keep hearing it. And that's another thing that it was grating to hear how many times must we hear that the children are going to win the day.
Yeah.
Youth are the ambassadors of now, that their idealism and resistance will save the day. And this is fine. I mean, it's a little silly to me. It's always been a silly claim to me, to be honest. Not because young people can't matter, but because the trope is doing too much work. You know, it's an optimistic hope, sure, but it's still largely just a sentiment. There's no sociological or philosophical proof that children are the saviors of our future. If that's the case, what has happened generation after generation, David?
Exactly.
Because my generation was promoted as the generation that would change everything. Then the millennials were. Then Gen Z, and they're already failing, according to people. So it's like this idea that the youth are the future and they're the ones who will save us all. It's kind of a naive thought to begin with. But hey, I'll shrug and say this is Star Trek. Star Trek in itself is a bit naive. You know, the idea that humans will achieve this level of progress and optimism is beyond me, and it will never happen in reality because humans are fundamentally broken.
Yeah.
But listen, naivety is built into Star Trek. But you don't need to keep on hammering home the theme and the naivety of it. We get it.
Well, on top of that is like, yes, Star Trek has that naivete essence about it, but it also has something to protect that naivete. You know, like the reason that one thing that I noticed after watching this episode is like, when me and you have covered past Star Treks, when younger, newer characters are guided by the older characters, it works. Because you have this communication, you have this rapport with, you know, old and new that's helping propel the new into the future. In this episode, you don't get that. It's just pure young angst. When you have a character like Janet Reno show up and try to give a lesson to Caleb. And honestly, it goes over my head because it really doesn't, it didn't matter. Because did Caleb learn anything from that?
That's the other point, is that he's just sitting around with a fucking attitude. I'm like, motherfucker, get out of here then.
Yeah, it's like, no, you got to actually have the characters communicate. Big thing there. They have to communicate with each other, even though the communication may be rough. You can't have zero communication, meaning you can't just sit there and sulk. They have the character sulk all day, because all it does is it drags your audience with this character. And then, like myself, by the end of it, I'm like going, "Whoo, that was a trek to actually drag. Yeah. That was a chore to get through."
Yeah. And I don't want to sound overly negative, but you know, this episode was a struggle.
It was a struggle.
And I have to keep reiterating that, because the next point is also a bit negative here. The deaf Beta Zed.
President. God. No, please. Please tell me I'm not the only one.
This is one of the fucking stupidest thing I've ever seen in Star Trek, Dave. It's just fucking stupid.
Come on, Mike. Tell me that basically me and you are on the same thing.
But David, this is where progressive emphasis on representation really fumbles.
Okay.
Because they want to represent diversity so bad. Yes. I'm not talking about Star Trek. I'm talking about in reality, producers of Star Trek in this modern era are so obsessed with diversity and representation. And I don't have problems with that. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
But when your emphasis is on representation to the point that it is illogical and makes no fucking sense, you're a fucking twat.
Yes.
Because rather than finding a place where that representation works logically, mm-hmm. because they could have made it work, but it would require work and effort. Rather than finding a place where that representation works logically within the world that's been established, you end up creating something that is frankly incredibly stupid, like the deaf Betazoid president, which is quite possibly one of the stupidest, dumbest things Kurtzman has allowed since handing Chabon the reins for Picard's first season.
But why, Mike? Why?
So let me see if I understand the logic here, Dave. Let's break this down, okay?
Okay.
You have a telepath, right?
Okay.
A Betazoid.
Yes.
Someone whose species communicates mind to mind. And this is a character who now needs to use sign language in order to communicate. Why? Okay. Well, let's go with this. Okay, fine. Yeah. You could argue.
If no one sees why me and you are kind of like scratching our heads.
Well, let's give them the benefit of the doubt. You could argue, well, maybe he doesn't need sign language when commuting with his when communicating with fellow Betazoids. But when he's speaking to non-telepaths, he does. Sure. Let's grant that premise for the sake of argument, Dave. But even then, two things immediately fall apart. First, Star Trek has already solved this problem repeatedly. We've seen technologies across decades of Trek where characters who cannot speak or cannot speak conventionally use technology to communicate. Universal translators, neural interfaces, assistive devices, direct thought-to-speech systems. This franchise bends over backwards to solve communication barriers.
Yes.
This is not new ground. Second, and this is the bigger issue. Are you ready? You're telling me that in the 32nd century, in a universe where thought can be transmitted across space, where language barriers are trivial, where consciousness itself can be digitized, the best solution available is American Sign Language? That makes no fucking sense.
Yes.
Not Betazoid Sign Language. At least give us Betazoid Sign Language.
Yeah.
Not some evolved symbolic system, perhaps, maybe. Not a neural projection. Not a Federation standard assistive interface. Just ASL. Which immediately collapses the illusion of the future.
Yes.
And reminds us that this isn't world building. It's contemporary virtue signaling.
Mike,
this is my problem when you put progressive leftist thoughts as a priority over logic.
Mike, do you remember the TNG episode Loud as a Whisper? That freaking made sense. And guess what? Deanna Troi was able to actually talk to Reva because why? She's a telepath.
And David, but that's the problem. You know, representation stops being meaningful when it actively contradicts the internal logic of the world. At that point, it's no longer additive. It's actually disruptive.
Yes.
And instead of expanding the universe, it shrinks it because it asks the audience to ignore decades of established technology, biology, and precedent in order to applaud the gesture. Oh, look, they're including a real life deaf person into the show. You could have done that and still maintained diegetic logic.
Yes.
And
yes.
Look, representation for many absolutely matters. No one is arguing otherwise. But Star Trek has always been strongest when representation emerges organically from its speculative logic, not when it's stapled on in a way that makes the universe feel less advanced, less coherent, and just less intelligent.
Yes. And that's the thing that basically baffled my mind when you have a
fucking dumb,
poor written episode like this one, and I know that people are probably saying that we're overblowing this.
No.
But here's the thing, as I said, when you have a good episode, we're willing to overlook that.
But I don't, if this episode was a 99% and they
overlook it
and they used ASL,
yeah,
then okay. I might just mention, really, American Sign Language? That's what you're going with.
Here's the thing, when it's a poor written episode, things like this, these minor cuts become gashes, because then you have like hardcore Star Trek fans looking at it going, wait a minute, why is she using American Sign Language when she's a fucking telepath?
I know, dude.
And like, because like she should be able to actually communicate to anybody with her mind. And just like you said, if they did this smart, if the smart thing would be, don't make the character a beta Z.
You didn't have to. Are we going
to
start introducing blind people now because you want to be inclusive? Like,
Geordi's going to be pissed.
The blind problem has been solved.
The blind problem has been solved. Geordi's going to be staying there, bitch.
In a world where you have pretty much, in a universe where you have pretty much rid illness, mass,
yeah,
disease, disability. Why would a deaf person even exist?
Yeah.
I don't fucking care about your diversity if it means putting in illogical things into Star Trek that doesn't just disrupt, it kind of breaks.
It breaks.
You kind of broke Star Trek in barely your second episode.
And as I said, it shows the lack of writer intelligence.
Yes.
And
it may not be ASL. I'm pretty sure they purposely used American Sign Language, so don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure that's what it was.
Because like,
even if it wasn't ASL, let's say it's some different type of beta Z, you know, sign language. It still makes no fucking sense.
They are telepathic. And I'm like, this is one of those moments when I wish to be in the writing room when someone pitches this, and I would be the first person to all of a sudden look at them and go, let me get this straight. You want to create a character. You want to make the president, the beta Z of Betazoid, use sign language. And then I would stop and look at them and I say, do you know what a Betazoid is? And then as soon as they basically tell me they don't, I would tell them to get the fuck out of the writing room.
Yeah, this is the problem when people don't live Star Trek, you don't understand what you're writing. And I don't know much about the showrunner that wrote the episode with Kurtzman, but it's not great, though.
Not great.
It really isn't great. And I it's a shame that you come off a strong introduction, the first episode strong,
with a weak episode,
and you come back with the second episode and it's this weak. Across the board weak. There were funny moments. Tig Notaro is fucking fantastic.
Oh, as always.
She's one of my favorite characters, dude. Fucking, I'm so glad that she's in this series. She just brings a certain level that feels like classic Trek. Her snark.
Snark, yeah.
Is very classic Trek in a lot of ways. It's reminiscent of McCoy and various other cranky Star Trek favorites.
Mm-hmm.
So it works. But ultimately, this episode is disappointing, and I hope this is a fluke, Dave. I do. Now, before we close out the discussion briefly, and this is meant more as a way to pose a thought for our listeners as a and less as a means for me to say I don't like it, and it has to do with Sam.
Okay, yeah. Remember we were actually talking about that in the last episode, that we were going to talk about this.
I want to keep this under 5 minutes.
Okay.
So we have Sam, first holographic student, the first of her kind, a being created with the explicit purpose of reintegrating into organic society. I don't understand what that means yet.
Mm-hmm.
Why was she created with the explicit purpose of reintegrating? Reintegrating. Integrating.
Yeah.
So at some point, did they leave society and just become their own isolationists as photonics? I don't know. That's a question we'll have to wait to see if it gets answered. She's programmed to feel 17 years old, yet she's only existed for a little over 4 months. Okay, so now on the surface, this is really cool. It's a cool idea.
It is.
It's classic science fiction, but we have to be careful with concepts like this. At least initially, this is my reaction.
Okay.
I'm willing to wait to see what they do with it. So I'm not saying this is a deal breaker, but you have to be careful because you can very quickly undermine the decades of philosophical discourse about sentience and consciousness as they relate to artificial life. What is life? I mean, how many episodes of Star Trek have we watched where the crew have to determine whether or not they should do something? Is this a sentient life form or is it not? And I'm not just talking about Data here. That's the obvious, you know, mm-hmm. when we talk about sentient life, artificial life. I'm also talking about more recent iterations, especially the Kurtzman era storytelling, or even something like Discovery can suddenly be treated as sentient. When sentience risks being reduced to a matter of programming, however, rather than something that emerges through, say, lived experience, struggle, memory, and the effects of time, we run into conceptual problems because if sentience is no longer something earned or developed, but instead something simply switched on, then the stakes change dramatically. It flattens the distinction between simulation and consciousness. It raises the question of whether sentience still means anything beyond complexity and code. And that's a much more radical claim than the show may realize it's making. So while the framework is, in fact, incredibly intriguing and thematically rich, it also, in my humble opinion, sits on a very fragile philosophical ground. If the series isn't careful, it could risk collapsing long-standing Trek debates about artificial life into something far thinner, you know, sentience as design choice rather than sentience as becoming.
As becoming. I can understand your point. I can understand your point about what the character of Sam does for the Star Trek lore as a whole. However, on my side, I am super excited for this because this is something that I feel Star Trek, especially Kurtzman's, this is something they have to dive headlong in. Because the idea and concept of a AI intelligence gaining sentience like this has been shown in Star Trek for so long. We need to see that evolution. Ever since V'ger ever got introduced, this idea of a machine type of being, a machine sentience, ascending and becoming something bigger, that's what Sam kind of represents to me, is like the idea of the AI becoming sentient. Yeah, it sounds terrible saying, oh, I'm going to flip a switch and suddenly I have the experience of a 17-year-old. Holy crap.
And I'm sentient and I can sentient. Join Starfleet.
But it also brings into the philosophical debate about, all right, well, what do you do with that sentience? That's what should matter. What does she do with that sentience of a 17-year-old? And it's like, that's why I like the play between her and the doctor in the first two episodes, is you could tell the doctor is very hands off of Sam, even though Sam is actually a fangirl of the EMH.
Yeah.
But like the idea that basically you have this character, the doctor, who has probably lived a thousand years and has basically
about 900 years
at this point. Plus. And he has so much experience. That's what made the doctor him.
You're not rebuttaling me. You're just saying that you like it because it's time for us to see it, but you're not saying why is it okay to you to see suddenly a creature that can just be poofed into existence as sentient when we have spent years, decades across multiple Star Trek series trying to unravel the mysteries of sentience and consciousness to only have a character, a photonic, now introduced that can be simply created as instant sentience?
Because it evolves the question of why, or no, the question of like how, and it evolves it into, okay, now that we know, where can we go with this? What can we do? What is, it takes the idea of sentience and, for me, it adds on to, okay, so what is the importance of is sentience? It adds so many more questions and much more philosophical things that like make my mind explode when it comes to the idea of being sentient.
So you're talking about, now you're not necessarily relying on things that we saw in the episode. You're saying that this is a good thing because you're speculating
that
it can open up new avenues of discussion around sentience and what truly is consciousness and life. Okay, I can see that, and I'm hoping that ends up being the case. That would be cool if they're going to use her as a question, much like good old Dr. Pulaski in TNG's second season, where yes. She was adamantly against Data being sentient.
Yeah.
I believe it was mostly the first half of season two was built around that. In fact, there was an episode, I believe, in season two where they put Data's autonomy on trial.
Yes.
So, okay. So if we're going to use Sam for that type of thing, then it could work. However, we have to also explain how something can be sentient at a push of a button, or perhaps maybe they are not sentient at a push of a button. Perhaps there is a growth period. Maybe there's an incubation period. They're not necessarily switched on and poof, we're sentient. I mean, there are philosophical arguments, Dave, from many philosophers about children who are alive. There are many philosophers who believe infants are not actually sentient.
Yeah.
They're blank slates. They're, what is it called? Tabula rasa, I believe is the Latin term.
Tabula rasa.
Like, they're blank slates. There's nothing there. Therefore, they're not sentient. It takes time and experience for them to become truly sentient. So that could be interesting, David, if that's what they're going to do.
Yeah.
But also, Something you mentioned before we started recording, when we briefly touched on this, you mentioned the other artificial intelligent life forms that were considered or set up as civilizations that we've never quite seen. For example, the civilization, the robotic civilization that remastered or reconfigured V'ger. You know, so okay, so if you have robots or artificial intelligence that can create or procreate, then the notion of artificial intelligence is already built into that civilization in itself, and procreation is no different than human procreation.
Exactly.
And you pass on sentience. It's a part of or contingent on your life in itself. So if that is what we're doing, if we're delving into that, then that could be interesting too. But we can't simply just say, hey guys, I'm a hologram and I'm sentient and I deserve freedoms and rights.
That's bad.
Yes, because then
bad.
Does that mean Nuss Braca's holographic projection on board the ship is in itself an entity? So, and I know that sounds really stupid even posing that question, but this is what Star Trek does. Mm-hmm. And that's why you need to be careful, because you can quickly unravel it all if you're not careful.
Oh yeah.
So,
and that's why I said, is I understand your concerns about it. I just see it more as the possibilities and I see the excitement of it. Want it.
And I agree. But like I said, make sure you actually do the work, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know what? This brings us to the end of our discussion. I'm going to give this episode a 55%.
Oh my God. I am going to give this a 55% too.
It made me a little sad when I wrote that down, but it's not a great episode.
It isn't. It just meanders and it doesn't do anything for the characters. You can honestly skip this episode.
All right. So hopefully we'll bounce back next week. I am looking forward to this show still. I am very happy that it is very different. That's not my issue. My issue has nothing to do with the newness of it and how distinct it is from other Star Treks. In fact, that's the plus.
That's the plus
of this series so far.
It's the quality of the production.
We got to get the writing there a little.
Writing bit. And the visual effects, please.
And this is a new showrunner. I believe her name is Noga Landau.
Mm-hmm.
Who's working with Kurtzman. She hasn't done much. As a writer. So hopefully Kurtzman and the rest of the writing team is going to help and assist as much as possible. Jesus Christ. Starfleet Academy has a 4 on IMDb. Jesus Christ. All right. Well, let's end on that positive note. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, David.
Thank you. Live long and prosper.
I couldn't help but notice your pain.
My pain?
It runs deep. Share it with me.
End simulation.